Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you have got this extremely impressive piece up at National Review Online. It's called China's Brilliant Insidious Strategy. And in this piece, you sort of walk readers through how China is currently positioning itself in the world and the strategic rationale behind it. It's a long piece. I'd encourage our listeners to read the whole thing. But I just want to get to the high points today in our conversation. Let's start with the topic that we hear about most often today, which is trade. And interestingly here, you talk a little bit about the sort of Chinese wiliness on this topic, but a lot more about the ways that over the years, Americans have tried to convince themselves that there's nothing to fear about trade with the Chinese. Explain that psychology and the various iterations of it we've seen over the past few decades.
Well, foundationally, a lot of people in the United States made a lot of money off trade in China. And it was part and parcel of American globalization, getting cheap goods. So there became these exegesis that arose to mask the idea, or not to worry about the idea we had. We're running up enormous trade deficits and hollowing out the interior. And one, of course, was, well, the richer China becomes, even if it's at our expense, we can do that for the world's good, because with affluence comes leisure, with leisure comes liberality, and they'll become like Carmel or Palo Alto someday. So let's just put up with it. That didn't happen. I don't think anybody believes that's going to happen anymore. And then another second rationale was sort of, well, it's our own fault. It's a free country. If we can't compete with them, maybe it's because we're too flabby or lazy. And we had a whole, in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, we had a lot of these blame it on the deplorables, irredeemables, the Midwesterners, as if they took opiates and drove away the jobs rather than jobs left and they took opiates. But there was sort of a self-incriminatory tone. And then we had the economists tell us, well, you know, trade deficits don't really matter, and they're not sustainable for, anyway, for China, these surpluses. They give cheap goods for a middle class whose wages are stagnant and gives them purchasing power. China won't be able to keep up the subsidies because they're not economically rational. And they make us more competitive. You know, it's a creative destruction. If China dumps a bunch of stuff and infringes on copyright and patents and da-da-da-da, which they do, then we'll just have to get leaner and meaner, and that'll make us more competitive. None of these things turned out to be true, because we have a $500 billion deficit, and China thinks it's a good thing, and we're supposed to think it was a good thing, and it's not. Because it has a deleterious effect on job creation and social and civic life. And then once you appease people, as we have been doing, we expect them to reciprocate with magnanimity, and they show disdain for our laxity. So China really has become arrogant toward us, their benefactor.
I want to talk to you about China as a neocolonial power. You say in this piece that there are two historical examples to think of as analogies to Chinese exertions overseas: the British Empire of the 19th century and Japan's Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere in the run-up to World War II. What are the important similarities that we need to understand?
Well, globally, China is now at the choke points of the world, in the way that the British had coaling stations dotted everywhere. On the Horn in Africa to get into the Suez, or in the Piraeus in the mid-Mediterranean, or in places in Pakistan, or in the South China Sea, or even in North America and Europe, China is leasing ports, and they're not very good deals for China. They spend billions of dollars to improve the port, and then to get a long-term lease, and you get the impression they're doing it to create a nexus of worldwide merchant and maybe someday warships that will be interchangeable in the way the British did it. And then more specifically in Asia, they're adopting the same mentality and methodology as the Japanese in the late and mid-1930s, which finally led to the Greater Co-Asia Prosperity Sphere. And by that, I mean, they're telling Asian neighbors and rivals that the United States is spent. It's tired. It's going the way of other colonial Western powers. China's ascended. They got to make a deal with China. they're bullying the Philippines, Southeast Asians, Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan, South Korea into more favorable commercial relations with them. They're trying to inculcate sort of an Asian chauvinism that we are all one people in the way the Japanese did, even as they have one of the most racist and bigoted policies toward religious minorities, ethnic minorities. And they pose as victims, as the Japanese did before World War II. The Japanese said, well, you cut off our oil. And, you know, we would say, well, you killed 1 million people in China, no wonder. But they do the same thing. They play the wounded pawn that, oh, you've said this about us, or you're not nice to us. And that's all a ruse. And it's to Trump's credit that he saw through it.
Amongst people who are China doves, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, you will sometimes hear the argument that, look, the Chinese aren't going to match us pound for pound in military resources anytime soon. It's a little alarmist for us to worry about their conventional military strength. How do you think about the current Chinese approach to military strategy?
Well, I was trying to use historical parallels. They don't believe that they can match ton for ton the American Navy. By that, I mean, they don't want to build 11 carrier groups and the associated ships and these multi-billion dollar fleets that would give them a global reach. But what they're trying to do is more like Germany in 1939 to 42, where they say, we can't match the British fleet, but we can make U-boats and make so many of them at such a cheap cost that we can deny entry into the English Channel, into the North Sea, across the Atlantic, even into the Mediterranean. And it was a real challenge to the British because they had all this investment and all these ships, but it was very dangerous for them to go places because they lost a number of carriers and battleships to very cheap U-boats until they developed a successful counter strategy. I think that's their strategy, to deny entrance of the United States into the South China Sea by an array of cheap frigates, submarines, and shore batteries that could send a storm of missiles in such a frenzy that it would be very difficult to get for a big carrier to avoid one of these small missiles, you know, speeding along inches above the water, and maybe 30 or 40 of them in clusters at night.
You spend a lot of time in this piece talking about the potentially malignant ways in which Chinese and American culture interacts. This is everything from Chinese students studying in the U.S. to the influence of Chinese money in American commerce, especially in the film industry, to China's understanding of American identity politics. Explain how this fits into Beijing's strategic calculus.
Well, I think they see the challenge as multifaceted. It's not military only. It's not political only. It's not cultural. It's not political. So it's not a ideological military rivalry like we had with the Soviet Union. They did not, remember, invest in American companies. They did not have ports throughout Western Europe. They did not have a third of a million students in the United States. They didn't have joint partnerships with American companies. They didn't go to Hollywood and say, we don't like that portrait of Chinese business people. You change it or we're going to cut our investments. They didn't have that reach, the Soviets, but the Chinese do. I mean, here in California, they can directly affect the real estate market in tony areas of Los Angeles or the Bay Area or Seattle or Portland. A lot of cash-strapped private liberal arts colleges depend on Chinese graduate students, which pay about 110% of the tuition and room and board cost. And they're very influential. I can tell you that if you write a column very negative of China, and I have in the past, I haven't heard yet from the Chinese consul, but often I get Chinese journalist or Chinese consul call you and try to correct your wrong thinking, as they put it.
Victor, if you were to trace the trajectory of pre-Donald Trump American politics, are there moments that stand out to you where we made the situation worse for ourselves, where we missed opportunities to, if not make China a more cooperative partner, at least keep some of their ambitions at bay?
I think so. I think when Bill Clinton, I think it was in last year in 2000, he announced all of these trade agreements with China, and he said that they were going to make us more competitive or they were going to improve our lifestyle. And then during the Bush years, when we discovered, I think it was 2005-06, that North Korea had in fact broken all of the Clinton-era agreements and was de facto a nuclear power, and we only had China to blame for that. And then yet we didn't say much at all to China. We laid off of them. Part of it was there was the assumption that our problems after 9/11 were in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Palestinian question, and China kept out of that, at least for a while. And so we thought, you know what? They're not bugging us. They're not bothering us. We've got to make sure the Saudis pump oil. We've got to make sure to restrain the Israelis, supposedly. We've got to reach out the Palestinians. We've got to stabilize Iraq. And we just didn't have the attention span, apparently. And meanwhile, China was taking us to the cleaners. And then we were worried about Russia during the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Obama administration, where let's have a reset, let's correct reset and get tough. Then there was collusion. But all of these distractions were kind of ironic because the existential threat has always been China. It's got 1.3 billion people, And it's got the world's largest, I think second largest trade surpluses. And it's building a military at a rate that we haven't seen since World War II with us or Japan, or Germany. So it's the existential threat to the United States because its system is so antithetical to our own. I mean, it's a communist, quasi-communist dictatorship. And it's used technology in a really Orwellian fashion to monitor its citizens and to pry and to round up people in re-education camp. It's kind of a nightmarish regime.
Final question that I'll put to you. Give us the decision tree going forward. What are the major variables on both the American and the Chinese side that you think are going to determine what this relationship looks like in the future? And what do you see as the most likely outcomes?
Well, I think in the short term, they're going to back down because one third of their population in the United States creates 2.5 times the gross domestic product of China. They don't have any universities rated in the top 30 in the world, research universities. I think almost everyone but 3 are American. We're the largest energy producer and exporter. We're the largest food exporter. We've got a very stable constitutional system. We've been able to deal with a multiracial population at least better than most countries. So China is an ethnically monolithic, xenophobic society that's authoritarian. It's coming off a legacy of killing 60 million of its own people. It's entirely mercantile. It has to export, often at a loss, for long-term investments to grab market share. And so what I'm getting at is it's much more vulnerable to a trade war than we are, if that's what you're going to call it. I would say in passing, though, if you think that China has been asymmetrical in its dealings with the United States, with infringements on patents and copyrights and dumping and currency manipulation and technological appropriation, I'd like to ask people, what were we supposed to do? What tools do you have, or what arrows do you have in your quiver? I think the only one you have is a tariff. And so when you slap tariffs on, everybody said this is Neanderthalism or protectionism or quasi-racism or something. But it's the only weapon that we have to get their attention. And they're much more vulnerable to it than we are. And so I guess that's a windy answer in concluding that I think in the next month they're going to quietly make concessions and come back to Trump and say, look, let us have $150 or $200 billion surplus, not $500. And then Trump will say that he halved the trade deficit, and that's success in art of the deal fashion.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.